discover, experience, repeat.
You are listening to Fly here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Melissa Rodway, and today I have explorer and speaker Mario Rigby in the studio with me. In late November of 2015, Mario left his life here in Toronto to embark on a solo 2-year trek from Cape Town, South Africa to Cairo, Egypt. This took him over 12,000 kilometers and through 8 different countries, all done on foot and by kayak. Mario has written a book with co-author Donovan Vincent about this adventure. The book is called Survive, My Quest to Walk Across Africa, and it comes out this spring in 2020. Mario is here today to talk about this incredible adventure and why he did it. So Mario, welcome to Fly.
Oh my goodness, thank you, Melissa, so much. Feel great to be here, very comfortable.
Good.
Love the space.
We're off to a good start. I love it. So let's start from the beginning of your life. You were born in Turks and Caicos. I think you actually just got back from there last night.
I did,
yeah. How was it?
I mean, I never complain. Every time I leave Turks and Caicos, I question myself, why have I left? Why am I leaving again?
To come back to Toronto, yes. It's a very good question. So you were born there and then you grew up in a small village outside of Stuttgart, Germany.
That's correct, yeah.
What was that all about? What took you from the Caribbean to Europe? Is it Caribbean or Caribbean? Correct me now.
So you can say Caribbean. We say Caribbean.
Caribbean.
And the Caribbean, we say Caribbean.
Gotcha.
Yeah, but you can say whatever you want. I think everyone would understand you. But yeah, I grew up in Germany. Like my early childhood experiences have been there. So I essentially grew up understanding the culture. The way to live was German. So you can imagine this like super awkward looking German kid, me and my brother actually, coming back to Turks and Caicos 10 years later, at age between 10 and 12,
wow.
We came back, and it was a pretty tough transition. I would say it's kind of like a reverse culture shock.
Yeah.
Where
you felt more German than you did.
It's not about feeling more like anything. It was more about how people treated you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we were strangers, and you know, we were teased a lot, bullied a lot as kids. Mm. And actually, funny enough, one of the things that they used to tease me about a lot, because you know, I'm a lot darker than a lot of my peers. I'm actually the darkest in my entire family. So they kept thinking like I'm African. So they would like tease me and say like, "Oh, you're African" and stuff like that. And at that time in the Caribbean, that is kind of like a negative thing to say. So negative connotation.
Mm.
But yeah. It was a hard transition, because imagine being raised in a culture that's the opposite of the other culture. Like Germans are, as you probably know, very like, you know, rigid, straight, and you know, everything must have order. And then the Caribbean is like,
oh, the complete opposite.
Yeah. When you say order in the Caribbean, you mean like, oh, you mean order some fish fry or something. You know what I mean? So it's like, yeah, the complete opposite.
Wow.
Yeah. And you have to transition into that.
And what was it like to have to learn German, the language?
I was
so young.
It was too young. Yeah. So it's my first language. It was more English that was very difficult to learn. In fact, I should technically have a German accent, but
but you don't.
It's because, like, you know, you've been teased or bullied into surviving to speak proper English so that kids don't detect that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
Wow. So you went back to Turks and Caicos from Germany for how long? Just to visit or to live again?
No, we lived there for about 6 years again.
And
then from the Caribbean, we felt like, okay, this isn't exactly the best place for us right now as children. So we moved to Hamilton. It's funny because my mom, she went ahead of us and she said, okay, we're going to go to Canada. And we had no idea where in Canada. First of all, my mother is probably more of an explorer than I am.
Oh, wow.
I'll tell you some stories later. And so she went ahead of us, a week ahead of us, went to Vancouver, said, we're going to move to Vancouver. So we flew in. Our ticket, we went straight to Vancouver. And right there on the flight, mid-flight, she changed the ticket to, I think, Alberta or something like that. So then we went to Alberta. And then from Alberta, she said, no, we're going to go to Toronto. And then from Toronto to Hamilton. And like, this is just me and my brother alone, right? Like, there was nobody, no adults at the time. So we were 16 and 14 at the time. And my brother's younger. And so we just did this crazy tour until we finally arrived to Hamilton. And we were like, what is this place? It's quite interesting.
Right. And yeah. So then you moved over to Toronto.
And then we moved over to Toronto, yeah. Well, I went to school at Western first. And then from Western, then I moved to Toronto, yeah.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a great story right there.
A childhood, yeah.
Yeah, amazing. So let's talk about your life in Toronto recently, because this adventure that you had just finished in 2018, mm-hmm. What were you doing in Toronto before then? What was your life like?
So I was a fitness instructor, and I also had my own gym called Magnus Training at the time on Bloor and Bay. Fitness was a passion of mine only because I ran professional track and field for a long part of my life. I competed in university and I competed for my country, Turks and Caicos. And that kind of inspired me to study, you know, kinesiology.
When you say you competed for Turks and Caicos, were you in the Olympics?
So Turks and Caicos is not in the Olympics, unfortunately, okay. Because we don't have the budgetary funds for that.
Mm. Mm-hmm. That's amazing, though. Good for you.
Thank you.
And so what made you decide to do this humongous adventure? What inspired you? Where did the idea come from?
Well, going back to when I was a kid, you know, being teased and bullied, you know, my mother was a great influencer. She always constantly kept saying, no, you're beautiful. Don't worry about it. You're special. You know how mothers can get sometimes. But she really believed that we shouldn't need to tolerate this behavior from the other kids. And that's why she brought us over to Canada. And when we moved to Canada, you know, we saw this show, me and my brother, called The Black Panther. It was a TV series on BET. I think nobody knows about this, just very few people. Everyone knows about, you know, Black Panther now because of the movie. But before that, there was a TV series where they would go through the life of, you know, Wakanda, like people living in Wakanda, and T'Challa, of course. And before he became king of Wakanda, he had to go through the ceremonial things that you saw in the movie. But there were things that they didn't show in the movie. And that was, before he became king, he actually did a walkabout throughout Africa. And that was really interesting to me because I saw that as like the most beautiful thing ever. I thought that was such a romantic story of seeing all these beautiful animals and the trees and, you know, the way that people were. He also got robbed by the woman he fell in love with. Mm. So he went through all of that experience. And I think that just kept like resonating with me over time. And I was really young. I was 18 at the time. And that's one of the things that really started to kind of shape my idea about adventure and who I was as well. That, you know, there's someone that looks like me on TV that represents, you know, Africa. And all the times that I was teased and bullied about kind of looking African, I say this quote unquote, because I used to have a negative connotation toward that as well. And that's only because, I was taught that back with my peers in school. And that show really made me feel proud to be like African. I was like, oh my God, now I want to be African. I want to be like from this place. These people are freaking brilliant. They're amazing. And nobody knew about this. Nobody. I would tell people about this show and they'd be like, all right, cool. Like, don't know what you're talking about, dude. So, you know, and that was kind of in the background for a long time, but it helped really bring my confidence up about who I was, how I look like, and how I fit into the world. But it was only later that I realized that you can make choices in life where either you choose to turn left or you choose to turn right. And for me, what that meant was I chose a life of adventure. This is who I was, right? Like, my father was in the military, and he would always show us pictures of him like skiing down sand dunes in Morocco and, you know, wrestling crocodiles and riding motorbikes in India and stuff like that. And so that was kind of like something we did every Sunday night, and we watched Discovery Channel together.
Oh, neat.
So bring all those things together. And I think that's what shaped finally my decision after, you know, being disappointed with like the jobs that I had. And I said to myself, you know what, I'm just going to do this. And I had one shot. I was 29 years old And I said to myself, you know what? I have one shot. This is my last shot to do this, to do something beyond amazing for myself, but also just to leave a legacy. And that legacy would be that it's possible anybody can do something spectacular, right? You just have to choose to do it in a way. And then once you choose, then you have to kind of follow the steps to go there. And it's so easy. Everything is available online. I never knew how to hike. I never camped before that time. I literally learned all of that a few months just before my trip to Africa, you know, so.
And is that how long it took you to figure it out? You decided and then a few months later you were on the road?
Well, it was, I think, 4 months before I decided. And then I did a practice tour. So it was funny. I decided to take my backpack because I was like, what does hiking feel like? Like, okay, this is how ignorant I was about it. Like, you know, people were like, Mario, you're crazy. You know, just like all kinds of things. I was like, huh, why are people saying all of this? Of course I can walk like 15 hours a day. Doesn't seem that bad. And then I did a training where I walked from Toronto to Hamilton.
Oh, wow.
And I did that in one day straight. That's the first time I ever walked for more than 2 hours ever in my life. And it took about, I think, 15 or 16 hours. My feet were bleeding. My thighs were bleeding because, you know, I was chafing. I knew nothing. I was wearing Converse shoes.
Oh, wow.
I put rocks in my backpack, like weights in my backpack. And I just went for it. And it was like a huge, like, fail / success. I say fail as in, like, I was hurting pretty badly. I probably could have prepared a lot better. A lot of people try to overthink and prolong things because they need to take time to prepare for it. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that gets people to not do what they're really passionate about or what they really need to do in life.
Yeah.
But I'm one of those people that, like, nope, I see it and I'll just execute it. Either way, right?
That's
and I'll fail many times at the beginning, like how I failed when I went from Toronto to Hamilton. But I did it. And nobody can take that away from me.
Yeah.
You know? My next job was like, okay, I did one day. Now I need to do Toronto to Montreal, 14 days. And I did that in 14 days. So I started to move faster than I did from Toronto to Hamilton.
And these are not beautiful hikes. Let's be honest. Okay, yeah.
Nah.
No, good training, though.
It's good training, exactly. And it's good training for speed. So I had a speed coach who trained me how to do fast, long walks. There was one time we walked, I think, 18 hours in a day. And by the time nighttime came around, I was hallucinating. I was bleeding through my thighs, chafing. I was wearing some underwear from a brand I'm not going to say. I really want to say their name. You know,
does it start with?
Let's say L, big L.
Gotcha.
Okay. and so, you know, and she was talking out loud. Like, we were hallucinating because we had no food. We were just going really hard. But I learned lessons from this. And I think a lot of people are afraid to fail, afraid to learn lessons. But that's what life is all about. It's like literally, if I didn't learn these lessons, then I wouldn't be stronger or better who I am.
Yeah.
People just want to learn everything right off the bat and think they're going to be perfect the first day. That's not how things work.
I love that this did not deter you. It made you keep moving ahead.
Of course,
that's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you had never been to Africa.
Oh, yeah. That was my first time in Africa,
too. That's amazing.
Yeah. So that was a huge surprise.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
And how did you determine what countries it was that you wanted to walk through?
So first I used Google Maps and then I realized it took me through like 5 war zones.
Oh geez.
I'm like, okay, that's probably not a good idea. So I decided to stay mostly along the coast and the eastern coast of Africa because there is a main road. But honestly, I did not know my entire route until I got to Africa.
Really?
Oh yeah.
So you're winging it.
I wasn't, okay, so I was like kind of, it was like a soft winging. So what that means, and I still do that now, so I'll plan a trip thoroughly, and I'll have like maybe 3 different options, right? And then I'll choose one of the 3 options when I'm there.
I see.
You see what I mean? So it's like, yes, it's not like a hard plan, like I can only go one direction, I can go 3 directions, but each one of those directions will lead me to where I need to get to. And for me, it wasn't to really just get to Egypt or to Cairo. Mm-hmm. It was to have that adventure, to have the journey. It was to meet the people, the locals. My journey wasn't about just completing it. If my journey was about completing Africa, I would probably have never made it.
Right. Because
the anxiety of, like, imagine 12,000 kilometers. every single day for 2.5 years, and if you think like, okay, cool, so now like 2.3 years now, 2.2 years, no, that would kill you. You would not make it, because mentally you would keep thinking about the end goal, and that would cause some fantastic anxiety. So I just kept thinking, well, what's the next village? What's the next city? What's the next adventure? Where am I going? You know, how's tomorrow going to look like? And I just kept thinking like that.
And so when you started out, you had no idea this was going to take 2.5 years?
Oh, I had no clue. I thought it was going to take like, first, I think I predicted 1 year.
Oh, amazing.
And then when I was halfway through, I think I lost count of like how many years. At one point I just gave up, and I was just like, I'm just going to like keep walking and just like, you know, when I reach, I reach.
And so the countries that you did go through were South Africa, Mozambique, Malawi, Tanzania, Kenya, Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt. Did I miss anything?
No, that was it. I did a detour to Uganda as well.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
but that was a detour, not part of the expedition.
These were all English-speaking countries?
Oh, definitely not, no. Kenya is the only English-speaking country.
Okay, but there's some English in these countries, but maybe not everywhere.
Yeah, like 1 out of 100 people. You just got to find the right person. But they usually come to you.
Right.
There were places where I've gone to where for days and days, no one spoke English.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you manage?
Sign language, you know, everyone knows what hunger looks like. Mm. Everyone knows what thirst looks like. And also learning phrases really helped. So like I have this book where I learned phrases from like 15 different languages.
Wow.
Including click.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
How did you do?
Not so good. I wanted to do it right now, but in case anyone here is speaking Buntu language.
Okay, let's move on. There are some fun facts here because everyone's obsessed with their Fitbits and, you know, they're marking their steps. So let's let people know that in those 2.5 years, you did more than 14 million steps.
Yeah, how did you get those?
I'm a good fact finder.
Did you look at it on my website or something?
I'm not going to tell you. Oh. apparently, you walked over 12,000 kilometers. Are these correct?
No, they are correct.
Okay, yeah. Great.
But I did it one time just to like appease the, as you say, the Fitbit, you know.
Yeah, 4.5 million calories, 7 to 8 hours a day you walked. How many kilometers on average would you say that you were walking every day?
Like a good hike would be 45 to 50 kilometers.
Wow, that's amazing. In one day.
In a day. I would finish around 5 o'clock. You start around 6 o'clock. Depends on the terrain, if you're going up or down.
So let's talk about the walking. So obviously this was a new thing for you, trekking. Mm-hmm. Did you get into the groove of it? How long did it take for you to adapt to this kind of lifestyle?
Like immediately.
It's addictive, isn't it?
No. There were many times when I really wish I wasn't walking.
Yeah.
But for me, the idea of continuing by walking was stronger than my discomfort of it. But there were times, honestly, there were so many times where I would wake up in the morning, I would start walking, and I just had this big smile on my face. I would just be like, wow, this, like, I'm so free. It's not even funny. You know, imagine just waking up out of your tent. You're in East Africa, and you can literally go wherever you want. And you're not limited by anything. It's just you and your feet. That feeling is probably the most freeing feeling that any human being could ever have.
And what was guiding you? Were you using a GPS? What were you using to know where you're going?
It depends where I am. But if I'm on the coast, you know, you're on the coast. Right. So you can't really just walk into the water. So you're like guided, right? There were main roads. I probably got lost out of the whole journey, I would say like 3 or 4 times, like not even, like it's really a no-brainer. Because there's a main highway all the way from Mozambique to Egypt, actually. Yeah.
Wow, so pretty easy to follow
just
that.
Just one road. There are multiple roads, but like, I mean, if you follow that one main road, it will take you there, right? I mean, obviously it's going through cities and the roads change up, and it's usually within cities where I would get lost. But other than that, if I would go off course, which is a lot of times actually, then I would rely on GPS. Or like when I kayak Lake Malawi, I actually use GPS most of the time. You're just going like due north and that's it.
So tell us about the kayaking. Why was that a part of this journey?
Because I got bored of walking, and and also because I'm an adventure seeker. Right. So I thought to myself, well, what's a harder way to get across Africa? You know what I mean? And so the lake actually goes from south to north. The original idea was to walk, kayak, and sail across Africa.
Oh, neat, yeah.
And then I took away the sailing because I'm like, you know what, that's too easy. Like, I could just pretty much, like, make it to Egypt right away in a few weeks. So I just stuck to kayaking. And by the way, I never kayaked before prior really? To that. Everything is learning on the spot. I'm trying to show people that literally you just learn quickly. Yeah. And you apply it, and you do it exactly as you've been taught. And it's about the confidence of that information that you learn. And then just like slowly by slowly, you just kind of like, you know, apply it more and more. But me learning was actually kayaking across Malawi.
Wow.
So I remember I did island hopping. So that was my first experience. And there were so many mistakes I've made. Like, I mean, I've capsized. My kayak sank a few times, like in the middle of the lake. And Lake Malawi is the fourth largest lake in Africa. Eighth largest in the world, but the second deepest in the world. So it has more body of water than most lakes on the planet. I think might be the third in terms of volume. So it is massive. It is a huge lake. And the waves turn about 4 or 5 meters within, I think, 10 minutes. That's what I've recorded, you know. And the only places that you can dock your kayak sometimes are in marshlands, which is where the hippos are,
yeah.
Or indigenous tribes that have literally never seen foreigners. So, you know, I spend a lot of time trying to avoid that and trying to avoid drowning. That's, I think, my main priority. Good thing I was a good swimmer.
I was going to say, could you swim or did you pick that up on the trip too?
I definitely learned how to swim a long time ago.
That's good.
But I did do training. So once in a while, what I would do is I would dock the kayak and I would swim like a kilometer every day. And that just like to build my my stamina. Man, I was really fit that time. Like I was... I wish I had that fitness level right now.
Yeah, it's not the same in Toronto, is it?
No.
You're fighting for your life. Let's talk about some of the challenges that you encountered. So you're going through a lot of different terrain. You're encountering different types of people. Tell us some stories about things that happened to you that maybe you weren't prepared for or expecting.
I wasn't prepared for the hospitality of most of East African people. They were so incredibly hospitable that it angered me at times. Because I'm like, no, take care of yourself first. Why are you taking care of me? You know, I was on TV, by the way, in most cities in Africa.
Oh, wow.
In fact, everywhere I went, they just like blasted me everywhere.
Did they know you were coming or they just saw you walking and they alerted TV?
That's it. They would, yeah. Either way, they
right,
would
right.
alert TV or a police officer would alert the newspaper. Like, oh, you must be in the newspaper.
Oh, neat.
Or, you know, someone that I knew. I always had contacts wherever I went, like from the United Nations or from wherever. Usually embassies, so Canadian embassies and whatnot, which I found Africans were so appreciative of what I was doing because, you know, it started off with like me just wanting to do a walk and it was for myself, you know. And then eventually it just blew up and became this other thing within Africa. Eventually I started recording like small films and small documentaries about local African people who are doing a lot of help within the communities themselves. And this is something I fell in love with because these guys were so incredibly intelligent, so smart and so willing, you know, to sacrifice everything they had to make sure that their community is good. And this is something we never share in the news. You know, we have this Western savior complex where, you know, foreigners will come in and help Africans. This is not the case at all because most of the foreigners that come to Africa and try to help are actually destroying more of the ecosystems unless it's like, you know, direct help for medicine like, you know, HIV and AIDS and also malaria. Like those things, okay, set aside, that helps a lot. But when it comes to trying to change a community and a culture for the better, then, you know, it usually leads to disaster in a sense. Like NGOs, 90% of them fail after, you know, 5 years later. And so I wanted to record what they were doing and capture that. Actually, one of my videos that I shot in Sudan was with a group of children, youth, who went around taking photos, right, around the Khartoum, the capital city of Sudan, and they would be arrested on the daily. And they were so brave, so incredible. I joined them along one day, actually a few times I joined them, but the one day I actually recorded with them. That had the most views on my YouTube, and that's because they were sharing it amongst themselves, you know, like wildfire, like because nobody was going out there really recording the positivity of Sudan. And if it was positive, it wasn't about the people. It was about the pyramids that they have there, because there's over 240 pyramids there that nobody knows about. People think that the pyramids are in Egypt, you know.
Wow, that's amazing. I love that message too. I've interviewed other people that have said the same thing, that people that think they're going to help these countries are doing more damage, and it's really just to make yourself feel better. Then you come home and you carry on with your lives, right?
That's it, yeah. I mean, imagine you taking a flight over to, I don't know, any country that is a developing nation where they need help, right? So you go there, you're spending $2,000 on a ticket. That airplane that you're going into, you know, is first of all polluting. So that's actually caused to climate change, which is the thing that is affecting those communities in the first place. And then you come there, you steal someone's job. Unwilling, like you don't know, but you know that happens, because why are you working there when there are local people who should be working building those buildings? And then not only that, now you're causing discrepancy between rich and poor, because you're living in a nice brick building with AC when the chief of the village is still living in a hut. A 17-year-old or an 18-year-old kid is living more luxuriously than the chief of the village. And, you know, they're showing all their iPads and, you know, so now these guys are going like, oh, you have all of that? So, and that discrepancy is what causes poverty. Poverty is a mental state to a certain degree. I mean, if all basic needs are met after that, it's a mental state, right? And Africans have told me this themselves. It's, you know, living in poor conditions and then seeing that other people living so much better, it's just, that's debilitating big time.
But the thing is that often people who appear to be living better are no happier, are they?
100%.
Yeah.
And I think this is becoming more and more known in some parts of Africa, like Kenya, Tanzania. They're really realizing this now. And so there's this big movement now that, you know, keep things African, which I think is a good move, because they want to keep their culture alive. They want to retain their Africanness, you know, because we're realizing that, well, the Western world has done certain things that are great, which is fine, but they've also done the thing where the end of humanity could be met. To bring that mindset to Africa, why would we want to continue destroying the earth? You know what I mean? So they're starting to smarten up and go like, well, no, let's invest in renewable and sustainable energy and things like that.
So people were very accepting of your journey, very interested. You were treated well.
Some people were. Again, 2.5 years, so many things happened. I got arrested.
Yeah, I had tell us about that. Come on. We got to know.
So the arrest is, so this was in Malawi when I was kayaking. And the only person there that spoke English in this village, remember, this is remote. Some of the kids have never seen foreigners before. And this guy, he comes up to me super drunk. He's the only guy that spoke English. And he's like wobbling over to me and he's trying to communicate with me. What do I want? And you know, I'm like, hey, listen, I just want to sleep here for the night. And tomorrow morning, 5 a.m., I'm gone on my kayak. That's it. Translate that to the chief, please. The guy spends like 35 minutes, 40 minutes trying to translate that. And I'm like, oh, this is not good. They're going back and forth. The chief is like lifting up my kayak. The guy is pushing it down. And I'm like, this is not good. And at the end, the guy says, yeah, you can stay. So I stayed. And, you know, I slept behind this restaurant on this smooth earth. The guy who owned the restaurant was super, super cool, super willing to let me sleep there. And two police officers come at 2 a.m. at night. I'm sleeping and with flashlights and two AK-47s pointing at my tent. You know, that was literally the most annoying thing I've ever experienced in my life. I was so mad. At this point, I was used to having AK-47s pointed at me and shoved at me and stuff like that. So I'm like, all right, no one ever uses these things anyways. So it was just more like anger. So they handcuffed me. They made me essentially unpitch my tent with handcuffs on, as a form of like humility. And that's because I think I was kind of being a smartass to the police officer, because he said it is illegal. Well, he was actually being, first of all, a smartass back to me. He said, it's illegal to kayak across Lake Malawi. I said, okay, I'm not even going to try to fight this one, but dude, you're wrong. Second thing is he tried to say that with his broken English, and then he says, oh, you're not wearing a life vest, so it's also illegal. And I was like, it's actually right in front of your face. Mm-hmm. It's like, you are telling me, and you know, so I wasn't even being a smartass. The answers were right there. Like, it's not illegal to kayak across like it. And there were like many kayaks on the lake as this was being said, you know, at nighttime because they're going fishing and stuff. I said, oh, yeah. So then they arrested me and then they put me in jail. I was there for 4 days, 3 nights. And that was interesting.
Were you scared?
No, not at all. I was angry. I was okay. Annoyed. It was just like, come on, man. I was bored. Because at this point, I was just living the adventure, you know. Mm-hmm. Again, this is one of those things that if your goal is only to make it to Egypt, you're not going to make it.
Right.
Because imagine if you had that mindset. But for me, that mindset was like every day is a life of adventure. Mm. So with that mindset, I was able to survive. And I think this is how life is as well. I think a lot of people, you know, they work for tomorrow. So they'll hustle and they'll strive to achieve greatness in their job placement, which means that they sacrifice their entire daily lives. They sacrifice being with their children. They sacrifice, you know, friendship and good times and just moments with themselves to try to achieve this invisible, ridiculous dream that we kind of make up here.
Yeah, the Western dream.
It's insane. It's like, what is, no.
Yeah, it's killing us, really.
It really is killing us. And I see it all the time, especially traveling back between Turks and Caicos and here. Like, I just came off the flight and, you know, everyone's so happy and looks so fresh. Even if you're 80 years old, you look beautiful,
relaxed.
And happy and relaxed.
Yeah.
And everyone's just like, Irie, you know. And then you come to Toronto and as soon as I get out the airport, I'm just like, wow, okay. Everyone's just like hustling, head down, gray. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, they're pushing for that, like the BMW, whatever it is that they want. And it's unnecessary. It's really ridiculous.
Yeah, and we're all just living for Friday all the time. I am.
Yeah. I hope so. Sorry.
And so you mentioned the tent. So were you camping all the time for these 2.5 years?
It varied. So, you know, there would be times I slept in palaces. There were times I slept in townships and some of the poorest places and the most dangerous places. And sometimes I camped out in safaris and places like that. Or by the beach. I think my favorite places to camp out was alongside the South African beaches. Yeah.
Oh, beautiful.
Incredibly, yeah.
And what was the food like from country to country?
All over the place. I would say my favorite is Mozambican food. Like, they just nailed it. They usually have this kind of spice. So it's a merger between Portuguese and African kind of Bantu culture. And they merge that together. And it's just like the perfect thing. It's like Italian food meets African food together, kind of mix that.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah.
That sounds really good. And you did get malaria for a couple of months. Is that right?
I did, yeah.
What was that like?
So malaria is something that I wouldn't wish upon the worst enemies. It is, you know, you can understand how and why it kills so many people. It hits you immediately. And all it takes is a tiny mosquito.
Mm.
And usually I cover up and I don't go out beyond 6 o'clock at night, so I avoid most of the malaria mosquitoes, especially knowing the areas, you know. And people would tell you, you know, they would say like, "Oh, this is like a malaria zone, so be careful." The local people are like that, especially if you talk to them. You know, you talk to any local people and you try to speak their language a little bit, they appreciate that big time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm a guest into their land in their area, so. But the mosquito that had given me malaria was cerebral malaria, which is the one that goes to the brain and essentially cuts off your nervous system. And you go into like convulsion and diarrhea, like throwing up, like shaking. I didn't sleep for 3 nights one time. And I'm just shaking and screaming out loud. And I was admitted to the hospital. Luckily, I had 2 nurses that actually found me who were German nurses because I slept at a backpacker's. I think a week before, and they were traveling too by bus, actually. And then they had caught up with me eventually. And they said, yeah, man, like you're really bad. So they admitted me to the hospital. They even stayed, once I got out of the hospital, they stayed with me in my room to make sure that I was good. So they like slept next to me in the bed to make sure that, you know, I don't like throw up in my mouth and things like that.
Oh my goodness, that sounds awful.
It was literally, I lost like 20 pounds that time, yeah. Immediately you lose weight, like you cannot fight this thing.
No. And you were just staying put until you felt better?
Absolutely. Yeah. Wow. Until I could walk. I decided to go on a vacation to Zanzibar, and that's where I stayed for like 3 months.
Oh, malaria is not so bad now, is it?
Exactly, yeah. Ooh. That was my excuse.
Oh, that sounds very nice. And what about mental health? So I'm sure there are days where you're like, why am I doing this? How do you push through it?
I never questioned why I did this. I fully understood that this is this is an epic journey, no matter what. Even during the hardest times, I would say, why is this day like this? You know, like on a really hot day and things are just not working out. You got aches and pains and it's just, you know, you have one of these days. But that happens to all of us for any occasion. Doesn't matter what you do or how much you love it. But mental state, I would say that there were times where I fluctuated between like just really healthy states. And there would be times where you kind of drop off of that a little bit. Like after my arrest, I was just like, I don't know, I started to drift. And so I think I may have drifted two or three times. And what I mean by drift is when you go through this state of not caring about anything, it's like almost like you're just this empty vessel, this empty body. Mm-hmm. And because you run out of fear, you have no more fear. And that's also, it's extremely dangerous, you know, because you could be walking without water or you don't prepare as much or you talk to people in certain ways that you shouldn't be talking to, or yourself, you're not healing your wounds, for instance. Like you have a cut and you see it and you don't care.
Yeah.
So I call that drifting. And that's how most people probably die when they do these like expeditions, when they're crossing the North Poles and things like that. So I experienced that about two or three times. One was on the beach, a beach trap where, you know, you're surrounded 120 kilometers around you, 360, that there is absolutely no water. And there was this one time I just said, like, I'm going to be done, so whatever. So I drank all the water in one time and, yeah, then I passed out, hallucinated, and it was near-death experience. Luckily, it was just before sunrise, so the sun just, like, disappeared just in time before probably death.
Wow.
So the timing just could not have been more perfect.
And is that how it was every time that you sort of went through this? Like, you just kind of came out of it?
How did I come out of it? I think it's just something that lasted for a day. I would say that I have strong mental fortitude. And the way that you become mentally strong is you have to love yourself. Mm. When I mean love, I'm talking about on a deeper level of understanding your connection to the universe. And what I mean by that is, you know, that you are part of everything else and everything is part of you. And to have this appreciation of existence is very unique. And to take that all in is so beautiful. So for me, I just kind of remind myself of that. And that kind of like wakes you up and you're like, whoa, okay, you know.
And you're on your own, but were you meeting a lot of travelers or were you really on your own a lot of the time?
There were a lot of times where I would meet travelers and there were a lot of times where I would just be on my own. So like through Sudan, I probably met one or two travelers. Just because not too many people are going to Sudan. Mozambique, I met, actually, it depends where you are, you know. And Malawi, again, depends where you are. But most of the time, there would be stints of, like, no travelers. And then you go to, like, where the beaches are or where the backpackers are or the cities. And you kind of meet them there.
Yeah. It's probably a bit of reverse culture shock, right? Running into people again when you're in all these remote areas.
Yeah, it gets really intense.
Yeah, and I bet.
You can run into like a backpackers and you know, everyone there is like telling their cool stories. Like, yeah, man, I took the bus across. And then I'm like, yeah, I walked. And they're like, whoa. and then everyone surrounds you and waits for like, you know, there's like this big fire and like story time.
Yeah.
And then you become like the legend
I'm sure.
of the place, you know.
Yeah, your journey is very different. You've gone through very different countries here, so the terrain, the wildlife must have been all over the map.
Africa is massive. America, China, India, Europe, and can all fit inside Africa and then some. It is massive. It is one of the largest continents on the planet. I think it took me 12,000 kilometers to get across. And what's the circumference of the Earth? Like 24,000 kilometers? So you're walking half the distance of the Earth.
Yeah, wow. And, amazing.
To, like, you know, sometimes I think about that and I'm just going like, what did I just do?
Yeah. And animals, wildlife, what was that like for you?
again, all over the place.
Yeah.
You have to respect where you go and you have to respect the animals. And when I ran into the hippos, for instance, you know, there was this point where it's either I go out into the lake and I die because of the waves were coming out like 4 or 5 meters and there's no light.
Yeah.
It, something happened to me because there's sharp rocks where I couldn't see. Had something happened to me, you know, I just disappear on the deepest lake, well, the second deepest lake on the planet.
Wow.
No one's going to find me ever again, you know, until like maybe 1,000 years later when they have technology and they can go in there. But they'd be like, wow, this is the guy that almost
made
legend.
It. That's the legend.
He almost made it. This is where he ended up. But animals were rife and they were everywhere. And it was so alien to me,
mm-hmm.
you know. But one thing that I understood was that we're also animals and we keep forgetting this. We think that we're so special, more intelligent, but we're not. We're just able to communicate exact information, and from that we can learn. But you know, no one person can make an iPhone. We all do.
Right.
We have to collaborate together to do this. Unfortunately, animals cannot necessarily collaborate in that sense and share exact information. But what they do share and what we share is empathy and respect. And you have to show animals exactly the same thing. I ran into, you know, large bull elephants. I've ran into families of elephants, like wild elephants. And that is something that, you know, most people on the planet can't really say.
Mm-hmm.
That experience is quite unique. You know, I've even stepped onto some of the most venomous snakes on the planet just by taking a leak on the side of the road with a puff adder snake. And the only reason...
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, right?
That's scary.
You get bit and you start bleeding out of all your holes.
Oh, wow.
It's intense.
That's dramatic, yes.
Yeah, and you have 15 minutes, essentially, or 15 or 20 minutes. It depends, you know?
Wow.
While you take the poison. The venom, sorry. Anyways, and the only reason it didn't bite me was because it had food in its mouth already. There were times I got attacked by dogs, so I was bitten by dogs in Ethiopia, crossing the border into Sudan. And I didn't treat it until a week later. And, you know, the wound started sticking to my pants. And it was really bad. This was one of those drift moments, actually. My drift where I was crossing the border because a lot of things had happened. That's a long story for maybe a book that you guys might buy later.
Yes, we'll talk about that.
I think the most dangerous animals were the mosquitoes. And maybe I had leeches as well, micro leeches.
I hate those things.
Imagine having thousands of leeches around your leg just by putting your foot in this like mucky water for like just a few seconds. Leeches just come.
Yeah. Was it easy to get medical help or no?
Oh, definitely not.
No, I wouldn't think so.
No.
So you're quite lucky.
Yeah, I don't understand how I'm still alive.
Yeah,
but, you know, not
your mental fortitude, I'd say.
You do, and you have to, when you see a problem, you have to address it immediately. And I think a lot of people, because we like to think that we're so special, we think that nothing really bad can happen to us. And I think this is particularly the case of Western people. And
yeah,
I was one of those people too. When I got shot at by the rebels in Mozambique, I was like, the only thing I could think about was like, this can't happen to me, no way. But then the bullets kept going, and then, you know, I'm hearing it come close by to me, so I was just like, oh, this is real life right now. I am just another person in this conflict.
So how did you end up in that situation?
There's a river crossing the middle part of Mozambique called Save Border. It's the Save River, and this is also a border. And the northern rebel tribes, part of the Renamo forces, are trying to blow up this bridge that, you know, that transports goods from the north to the south. The south is where the government and the big money is, and the north is where all the resources are. So there's this, like, you know, this conflict between who runs the northern part and who runs the southern part. Unfortunately, people are in the middle of this conflict, so I don't feel so too bad about myself. There are a lot of people who suffered way worse. And I remember just the day before I crossed that border, I was warned that I should not go there by a Mozambican guy. So I was like, whatever, I'll just do it anyways. So I did it. I took the chance. But as that happened, the military convoy, which is super lucky of me, came by and they literally just like forced me in the back of the truck. So we're riding, you know, 100 miles per hour across the border. And there's no way I would have survived this had I been walking, because I look like I was a soldier. I was kind of based on my gear, you know, using military boots and stuff like that, and my big backpack. So all of a sudden, they started firing at us. We're talking AK-47s, and there was apparently three guys in the bush, and they were, you know, they aimed at the truck, and you could hear the ding ding, and it stopped. The truck stopped. All the six soldiers in the back of the truck jumped out. Two soldiers in the front. The music is still going on in the truck. You can hear the Mozambican music. And it's just like 15 minutes of gunfire going back and forth. And
then, oh, my God.
In the back of the truck, like going, I think I was screaming. Like I was just going the F words, you know, multiple times. And then I decided, okay, well, now it's whatever. Now I'm going to start recording. So I took out my phone and started recording the whole thing. If you go on YouTube and you just look up rebel soldiers in Mozambique, my video is probably going to be the first one to show up. And it just basically shows like a glimpse of how that would look like. And I jumped out of the truck because I'm thinking they could RPG this truck. You could see discarded vehicles that had been bombed. You could see villages that were burned on fire, because what happens is the government goes to those villages and burns them, because those villagers are paid by Renamo forces to take fire, to aim fire at the government. Right. So anyways, I'm extremely lucky to have survived that situation.
Totally.
And even from the government side, because I was recording and you're not definitely not allowed to record. Yeah. Someone did catch me, but I drove off just in time.
Do you have PTSD from this trip?
I had it. Yeah.
I'm sure.
Like immediately after the trip, I think, you know, I started to come back into the Western world and I was just like so dazed at how people are complaining about how
stupid,
like,
things.
Really dumb things. Mm-hmm. Like how outdated their shoes are. I'm like, are you kidding me right now? There are way worse things in the world right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, relationship issues that don't make any sense. I'm like, just tell this person how you feel.
Right.
You know, things like that. If I had held things in like that, for instance, I wouldn't have survived. And you have to be very open. You have to be very vulnerable. And you have to be able to survive on whatever it is that you have. And you have to be content with that. If you're not, again, as I mentioned before, you're not going to survive Africa.
So this was a journey that was not planned, really. So how did you know when it was time to come home? How did you know it was over?
Well, by reaching the top.
Yeah.
Okay,
that's
so
a fair point.
I made it to Cairo. Mm-hmm. I was going to make it to, I did make it to Alexandria, but I didn't walk that distance to Alexandria. It was just like another couple of hundred kilometers. The reason I stopped in Cairo was because that's where the pyramids were. And to me, that was very significant. It's like, it showed a significance of greatness, of human achievement that to this day we can't explain, right? But I mean, as humans, as a humanity, actually, we've gone through so many different civilizations, so many empires that have all fallen and risen and fallen for the last 15,000 years when we, you know, started to create societies. And to think that this one here is going to last forever is ridiculous. I've been to ancient sites where, you know, I saw three different generations of empires stacked on top of each other, you know, because empires like to be around where resources are. So they're going to build on top of each other. And, you know, as I was at the site in Sudan, they were actually excavating, and they had just found it that week, an ancient civilization that was over 5,000 years old, deeper than the one that they were researching and looking for.
Wow.
And I was able to, like, even pick up this mummy that, like, it was incredible. Like, you know, just a fresh mummy out of the ground that had an entire life. That was an incredible experience, yeah. And when you see things like that, when you're there and you see the site, it gives you a unique perspective about who we are, you know, what we're doing, our perceptions about life, and all our ideologies and ideas are these, like, things that we make up in our head. At the end of the day, we want to live healthily. And that's, to me, that's the number one thing that matters. And everything that I do today and in the future has to do with the well-being of mankind. And if you have an ideology that doesn't fit into the picture of the well-being of mankind, and that what that means is just like, do you have clean water?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have food, healthy food? Do you have shelter, security? And do you have the ability to grow yourself? For me, those are the things that if you do not match that, I don't care about your culture, ideology, your religion, or anything like that. What I care about is the well-being of mankind and the animals that live on this planet.
You mentioned earlier in this discussion about watching the Black Panther, about being bullied in your life. So why, as a Black man, was this an important adventure for you?
This, as a Black man, was actually quite important to me, because when I started to research about how to walk across Africa, I couldn't find anything, first of all, on that particularly. And second, I didn't see any Black people, adventurers. I didn't see any Black explorers. There was one female, I forgot her name, but she was an astronaut that went to space. She's, I think, the first Black woman to go to space. She also climbed Mount Everest. And so she was the only one. But unfortunately, I didn't see many females. And now, today, I know so many females that are incredible explorers. Like, I look up to them. I have a mentor. Her name is Kelly Edwards. She's American, and she is so incredible. She's a pilot and a deep scuba diver, and not just any pilot. Like, she flies some of the most ridiculous planes. She goes to places. She's met me in Turks and Caicos randomly, just on a whim. And, you know, she's my mentor, and I don't understand till this day, like, you know, she should be represented more as an explorer. But, you know, she happens to be a Black woman, and you know, me as a Black man, it's we're not really represented in the outdoor industry at all. We're starting to see them trying to put an effort into it now. And that's mainly because of myself and a few peers that are really pushing out, you know, that there are other people on the planet that can explore. You know, it's not just the Europeans, European males that are exploring. It's everyone, really.
Yeah. It's true.
Actually, one of the greatest explorers of all time was an African man, and he was also the wealthiest man on the planet. And he went around, did a tour, and gave out money, unfortunately also slaves, around the world. And he, you know, he was celebrated as the greatest explorer. But because the conquerors are, you know, Europeans, they hold on to their history, their story, you know. But there are so many more beautiful variations to who we are as people. And for me, it's not a race thing. It's not a race thing or a gender thing. It's like the movie Black Panther. That had brought in more money than most of the Marvel movies that have ever, you know, existed. And the reason for that is because people are just looking for diversity. They're just looking for something different, something fresh. And that is. So it doesn't have to be about race. It's just, this is a different culture. That's all. So I wanted to go to Africa and explore Africa as a Black man to see just how it is. I used myself as a guinea pig, and I think it turned out quite well. And I think also I'm using myself as an example, a living example of what it would be like to have a Black explorer, you know.
Amazing. Mario, we are running out of time. Can you believe it? I could talk to you forever.
I told you.
I know. You warned me. So people should know that your book is coming out in the spring 2020. Do you have a date?
Yeah. So it's not actually coming out spring 2020, unfortunately. It'll probably come out 2021, 2022. Unfortunately, it's just working on so many other projects at the moment. There's a film coming out, which I'm working on, which is Cycling Across Canada film.
Yes, let's talk about that. So why are you doing that?
So I just did it because I was bored that summer, and I was just like, let's just do something, you know? So I decided to cycle across the continent, actually, because I also went down to United States, so North America, from the West Coast to the East Coast. And I went to the furthest point of the East Coast and the furthest point of the West Coast.
How was it?
It was cold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a big trip, that.
It was big, yeah.
Did you know how to ride a bike, or did you learn you how know to what? Do that too?
I knew how to ride a bike, but I've never done more than 20 kilometers in my life. Yeah. So I've never done like a big journey like that. So I started off in Vancouver with a big journey. And on my first day, I broke the shaft of my bike.
Oh,
it was just
wow.
Like, just boom, it was cracked. Yeah, so.
And you have another big adventure coming up this year. You're going to Africa again.
So I'm going to Africa again, but that's it's part of a tour. So I'll be taking people out as a tour. But my big expedition that I'm doing is in Nunavik. I'm going up there with a photographer, a videographer, and we're looking at how climate change is affecting indigenous tribes in the most northern parts of Canada.
This voyage that you did has really changed your life, obviously. Now you're just full on adventure, would you say?
I would say I'm living the dream of, I mean, this is what I would do if I was a child, literally.
Amazing. Yeah. It does make you feel younger too, right?
It does. Exploring, I think, the world. Makes you look younger too.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. So the key to looking young, ladies and gentlemen, is doing what you love to do.
Yes, it's very true. So will the book still be called Survive My Quest to Walk Across Africa, or is that changing too?
Like, I mean, let's, I don't know. I'm like tight tongue on that one.
Okay. So we should look for this book in the next year or two.
In the next year or two. But yes, that would be the name of the book we agreed on. So the reason it's slowing down is because I think there's so many deeper parts to this book that I want this not just to be a story about walking across Africa, but I want this to be a story about, you know, how to overcome any challenge and how to, like, how did I, you know, mentally overcome these things? Because there was a lot of situations where I think most of the human population would just quit.
Yes, or, absolutely.
You know, you would die, or you would, you know, you would just like kind of like wave your flag and say that's it. But mm-hmm. I just kept going. And the reason for that is there's a reason for that. And there's a method. And that's what I've been using. So before my book is out, I'm just doing a bunch of talks. And these talks really talk about like how I'm overcoming these challenges.
And you have some great social media out there as well, because you documented a lot of your travels.
Yeah, that was the crazy part. That happened accidentally, actually. It was, I think the first part of my trip, I was only using Facebook and I would post once in the blue moon. And then it was like African people that taught me like, oh, Mario, you must use the Facebook and the Instagram together. And I was like, what? All right, cool, let's do this. Teach me, man. So they were like, you know, so all the kids would Amazing. Teach me all from, especially in Sudan, they really pushed it to me. And you would think out of all the places, right? Like, I mean, in the desert.
Yeah. That, amazing that, isn't
right?
it?
Yeah. And they taught me how to be minimalistic about using equipment, like instead of having a tripod, they taught me like bend your knees and like, you know, do this kind of stuff. And, you know, instead of like transitioning from one scene to the next, you know, like the swipe the camera really fast in one direction and then the next scene swipe, continue that swipe in that direction. And that causes like a manual transition.
That's cool. Yeah. It's those experiences that also make you realize we are all just the same, right? When you
Literally
can collaborate on a project like that.
100%.
Isn't that cool? Okay, so we sadly have to go. So people can look you up at mariorigby.com. Where else can they find you?
Definitely, I'm pretty heavy on Instagram. I'm shooting a docuseries right now from Turks and Caicos Islands about the culture, the history of the most beautiful beaches in the world and the people that live there. So you can find me at Mario Rigby, which is on Instagram.
Are you still a trainer or do you have time for that?
Oh my goodness, I quit that like 5 years ago.
Good for you.
Yeah,
not looking back.
No.
Will you come back on our show again?
Absolutely.
It's been amazing
it's
having
fun.
You here.
It's a lot of fun here. Yeah.
It is fun here,
Thank
isn't
you for
it?
Having me.
Thank you. So we have been speaking with Mario Rigby again. He did this amazing 2.5 year trek across 8 countries in Africa. And do definitely follow him because there's a lot of inspiration here. So thank you so much, Mario.
Thank you so much, guys. And thank you for listening. Thank you, Melissa. Appreciate it.
Immediate boarding, please. Gate H1. Discover. Experience. Repeat. Discover. Experience. Repeat.
Fly.